Chag Sameach, everyone, and a very, very warm welcome to a very exciting Yom HaAtzmaut edition of Psychology and the Writings of Rav Dessler. They tell a story about a rabbi who passed away at the age of 120. And he goes up to the pearly gates and he's waiting his turn on a big line. And he's pretty confident he's going to get into heaven, but he's also a little bit nervous if he's going to get into heaven. And right in front of him is a secular Israeli cab driver. And he's thinking, oh, like, let me get a sense of, like, a barometer of what the standards are for this heaven business. Let's see how the Israeli cab driver does. And the rabbi, this great Rosh Yeshiva, who's given many shurim and had a shul for many years, he watches as the Israeli cab driver goes. The angel in charge takes a look at the cab driver's rap sheet and says, go right in. The rabbi says, oh, this cab driver gets to go in. I'm going to be a shoo-in. The rabbi comes and they open his file. They look through his papers and, sorry, rabbi. You're going to have to go down a little bit. He says, what? How could that be? Do you know that I was a chazan for Ne'ilah for so many years, and I was a rabbi giving sermons and inspiring the masses, and this Israeli secular cab driver is going right to heaven? How could that be? And they said, rabbi, you know, the truth is, when you prayed Ne'ilah, everyone checked their watches and tapped their foots nervously, waiting for you to finish. When you were giving your sermons, everyone fell asleep. But when that guy drove, everyone prayed. I've heard so many stories about Israeli cab drivers in Israel, and they're great ruchnias, the great ruchnias of Israeli cab drivers. I remember when I was learning in Israel, in Yeshivat Shalavim, in Shana Aleph, I was Motzei Shabbos taking a cab somewhere back from where I was for Shabbos, and the cab driver, who wasn't wearing a kippah, he asked me, where are you studying? What are you learning? So I'm learning Masechet Bava Metziah. So Bava Metziah, and he starts reciting the whole Masechet Baal Peh, just on his fingertips. Well, his fingertips were on the wheel, but he knew it all. He knew the entire Masechta. And they call these stories only in Israel. Only in Israel did the cab drivers have the ability to know all of Masechta Bava Metziah by heart. Only in Israel did the cab drivers have a special level of Kedusha. The special, unique relationship that we have, Bin Adam L'Chaveru, with all of our fellow Jews in Israel, it's an only in Israel story. Only in Israel. Rav Dessler has a beautiful essay about the unique relationship between us and Hashem, Bin Adam L'Makom, that I like to call Only in Eretz Israel. It's an only an Eretz Yisrael type of relationship. Now, this essay was delivered in England in 1946. This is before Hakamat HaMedina, before Rav Dessler moved to Eretz Yisrael himself in the late 1940s. We spoke last week how Rav Dessler lived through the Shoah, but not directly in harm's way. He also lived through Hakamat HaMedina. He spent his final years as a Mashkiach Ruchani in Panovich Yeshiva in Bnei Brak, which, despite his more classically Haredi affiliations, Panovich Yeshiva, Rav Kahaneman always flew the Israeli flag on Yom HaAtzmaut in Bnei Brak. So a special affiliation between Rav Dessler and Eretz Yisrael, and eventually Medinat Yisrael. Beautiful essay to understand only in Eretz Yisrael, a special relationship that we have with Hashem only in Eretz Yisrael. So we have our sources for tonight. This comes from volume 4 of Michtav Me'Eliyahu on the bottom section of the page. Kelim Shel Chutz La'aretz V'Shel Eretz Yisrael. The vessels, the vehicles of Chutz La'aretz versus in Eretz Yisrael. It's a beautiful, beautiful essay. Perfectly timed for Yom HaAtzmaut. Rav Dessler starts with talking about a story in Sefer Bereishis. When Yaakov Avinu has been at Lavan's house for about 20 years, Yaakov Avinu was the first person to really experience a terrible gullus. After living and growing up in Eretz Yisrael, Yaakov Avinu was forced to run away, and he's nervous, he's scared. He davens Marav, Be'ez Tzara, he's traveling, he's nervous if he's going to come back safely. And at the end of his time at Lavan's house, Yaakov has amassed many children. He has 11 sons and one daughter. He has great wealth. And at the end of his time there, Rav Dessler quotes, B'nei Lavan Amru, U'me'asher li'avinu asas kol ha'kavod hazeh. The Yaakov Avinu's great wealth, all of his success, came from us, from our father. Yaakov achieved it here in Haran, in our father's household. And Lavan himself, when he chases after Yaakov, he says, Lavan Amar, V'chol asher ataro et lihu. Everything is mine. The daughters are my daughters. The grandkids are my grandkids. The money, the sheep, the wealth, it's all mine. Now, on the face value, what Lavan's kids and Lavan are saying is that you stole our stuff. You came into our home, you cleaned ship, you cleaned everything out, and you stole all of our stuff. Rav Dessler has a beautiful, deeper message over here. All the things that Yaakov Avinu earned, including his children, in Chutz La'aretz, were claimed by the people of Haran, Lavan and his children. V'yesh b'dvarim eila, ezo b'china shel emes, there's some truth. Despite the greed that is a lie, Yaakov Avinu with the sheep and the spotted and the speckled and the sticks, Yaakov Avinu earned everything he earned. He worked extra years for his wives. Yaakov paid his dues. But there's some truth to what Laban and his kids say, that everything you have, Yaakov, really comes through us. The Torah wouldn't have recorded this terrible, greedy response of Laban and his family had it not been that there's some truth to the fact that everything, the great wealth, the great blessings that Yaakov has accumulated were all from Laban, were all from his family. What is the idea? Any success, any progress, any blessings that are gained outside of the land of Eretz Yisrael are coming as a vehicle through the leaders, the politics, the government, the streets, the stores, the economy of the nation, of the country, of the land where it takes place. Jewish people wandered around a lot, many times, on many different continents, in many different countries. Rav Dessler is saying that what the Jewish people are able to accomplish in the area of Kedusha, the Torah learning, the Midos, the Chesed organizations, whatever Jewish people are able to accomplish and build in a foreign land has a flavor of that foreign land, is filtered through the prism of that country in which we are staying and governed. Ki gam derech avodas Hashem sham, hi lefi bechinas hamida hahi. Even the spirituality, even the ways of serving Hashem are, I don't want to say tainted, I'm not sure he's pointing out something terrible, but they are filtered, they are primed, they are adjusted based on the flavor of that country and that culture, which we'll explain with some beautiful examples in just a moment. By contrast, Avo Be'eretz Yisrael, Ha'ashpa Ba Derech Yishara Me'ito Yisbarach, on the top of the next page. And we're going to turn back just to the footnote, which is a beautiful footnote. In contrast to Chutz La'aretz, where every blessing, every success comes through the prism, through the filter of that country's nature and culture, in Eretz Yisrael, we have a direct relationship with Hashem, where everything comes mano a mano, just one to one. Ki avod Hashem hi b'derech l'shma levad. Turn back to the first page in the bottom. This footnote is my favorite thing of tonight's shiur. If you got nothing else out of tonight, and I hope you do, this footnote is unbelievable. Footnote number one. Rabbeinu Zatzal hidgim zos b'ha'ira. The author, the arranger of the Sefer Michtav Me'elio, quotes Rav Dessler as having said, an example, what he means when he says that all the Avodas Hashem in Chutz La'aretz always has the flavor of the country through which it comes. Listen to these examples and how true they are. L'mashal, Sharusim heim chamei regesh. He says Russians are known for being very passionate people. People with a lot of heart, people with a lot of emotion. If you don't agree and you're Russian, please don't hurt me. But this idea that Russians are very passionate, excitable people. V'ofen Avodas Hashem shitbateach sham. Haya HaChassidus. Chassidus developed in Russia. A movement which focuses much more on being heartsick, on singing, on dancing, on interpersonal relationships, on focusing around a charismatic leader, the Rebbe. Chassidus only could have come about in Russia because it takes the flavor of the country and the culture, which is much more heartsick, much more heartfelt. And the Jewish Avoda that came in Russia in the 1700s, 1800s, necessarily became adjusted and flavored by that culture. Another example, Halitian, Litvaks, Lithuanians, Galicianers, Heim Karim Umechushavim. They're more cold and calculated and very cerebral. Va'ofen Avodas Hashem Shitbateach Ba'artzam. And the type of Judaism that developed in Poland, in Lithuania, Haya Iyun HaTorah V'Limud HaMusar. The idea of introspection, the idea of intense Torah learning, yeshivos being founded in Europe, that's not an accident. That became the norm filtered through the culture, a Lithuanian culture, that focused more on intellectualism. Hagermanim, Germans, what are Germans known for? Makbidim ma'od al mashmas v'seder. Germans are known for their order, for their rigidity, for their faithfulness, for their very strict, very pristine and clean. And which kinds of Jews came out of Germany? On the next page, in the footnote, where the arrow is. V'sham, the Jews who went through Germany, hitbateach, hitpatcha avodas Hashem, shel kaptanus, b'shmiras misarasim menhagim. The Yekis who came through Germany, have a very sense of strong sense of menhagim, a strong sense of punctuality, a strong sense of order and faithfulness. How do you like that? The Jews, throughout the millennium, throughout the centuries, that have been developed their Jewish institutions through the prism of the host culture. Russian Jews like this, Lithuanian Jews like this, German Jews like this. And Jews are very different. Sometimes it leads to different interesting situations. You know what they say? You know what happens when a Yaki family marries into a Hasidish family? You have a wedding that starts exactly 2 hours late. Exactly 2 hours late. We can think of other examples too. He doesn't give the example. But I think of Jewish communities in America. America, Medina Shel Chesed. The world's superpower. That gets involved in everyone else's problems. To supply aid to countries in Africa. That's America's business. America is all about taking care of the entire world. The Chesed organizations that have developed through America, like nothing else. Bikur Cholim and the Hatzalas and places that are organizations that are other places too. But the amount of Chesed from Jewish people in America is not an accident that it's Medina Shel Chesed. The wealth and the generosity that filters Jewish Avodas Hashem through the prism of the host culture. And he concludes in this footnote, Kach shekol gola hishtamsha letzorchei hakedusha bekelem uvemidos shel ha'uma shegaru bekirbah. That's how it works. Every exile, every foreign country that we are in, we find a way to use the surrounding tools, the surrounding culture, as a way to enhance and to flavor differently our Avodas Hashem. V'haynu hashpas sarya umos. So Lavan's family was right. When they claimed that everything Yaakov Avinu earned in Chutz Laretz was really theirs, on a greed level they were wrong. Yaakov Avinu worked very hard, he earned it fair and square, no question about it. But they were right when they said everything is ours. On a metaphysical level, everything Yaakov Avinu earned in Chutz Laretz really did come filtered through that perspective. It really did come differently because it was Chutz Laretz. Yaakov did not earn his sheep or his wealth or his children in Eretz Yisrael. And because of that, there's some reason for the leaders of that country, the Lavans and his officers, to say, we produced that. Because he did. If it's not Eretz Yisrael, where there's a direct one-on-one connection with Hashem, who is the Tsar, who is the Melech, directly in Eretz Yisrael, then it's indirect. Hashem filters his bracha, and we filter our tefillos and our avodas Hashem in a way that takes on the nature of the host countries. I was thinking that the Rambam in the sixth parak of Hilchos Deos writes very, very extensively about the power of one's culture. How a person is influenced according to their surroundings, and the Rambam writes, the person is living in a terrible city, move to another city. If you can't change the people around you, change the people around you. You can't change the people around you by making them be different, then change the people around you and move somewhere else. And if you can't, he says, move to a far across the world. And if the government doesn't let you because there are guards keeping you locked in, you don't have a visa, and you can't leave, then go crawl in a cave somewhere. This is the Rambam, a rationalist, telling people to live in a cave if you can't find a better surrounding. But it's not a question of, are you going to be influenced by your surrounding? It's a given. People are influenced by their surroundings. The only question becomes, which surrounding are you going to choose? Which culture? Which environment? Both on a national, community, and day-to-day workspace, whatever culture we choose really affects the way that we are. But Adasar is saying more than that. It's not just a matter of we are influenced by the people around us. There's something special here. There's something metaphysical going on, that all of our Avodas Hashem is being filtered through this lens, and it's taking on the nature of the host country. There's a lot of beautiful research in the area of social psychology about the ways in which different cultures and different languages and different philosophies impact our psyches, impact our emotional reasoning, our cognitive processing in ways that we wouldn't have thought were affecting us. A lot of studies have been done with people who are bilingual. Anybody here bilingual? Anybody here trilingual? A lot of us say we're bilingual because we can translate a couple of Hebrew words, but like really, truly bilingual. Grew up in one culture and moved to another culture. Studies have shown that people who are bilingual report feeling different emotions when they think about the same event in different languages. Because one way to think about it is that, well, it's their early associations. People, when they think in their natural language, maybe they think of their childhood and their parents and their schools because they grew up speaking this language. And later they emigrate somewhere else, and then they had different associations with the language. I had a patient today. I'm going to change some details to protect the privacy of this person. But I saw a person today out of the community who was a student who had moved here from Russia. And she said that she had never been in therapy before, and she had never spoken about her experiences before, and it was uncomfortable for her. And yet she found a way to sit there and speak in very heavy accent, very heavy Russian accent. She spoke about her different experiences of loss and pain and different struggles going on. At the end of the session, I said, well, what was it like for you to come really have your first therapy experience talking about such personal things? She said, what really sticks with me most is that I've never spoken about my feelings in English before. So I grew up in Russia. Whenever I have spoken about feelings to my family and others, it's always been in my native tongue. And here, speaking about my feelings in a different language, it made it very different for me. I saw things in a way I'd never seen them before, having to use different language to describe it. A lot of studies show that when people pray in different languages, it changes the tone, changes the flavor of their emotional experience. Lying in different languages comes out differently. Saying I love you in different languages has a different effect based on whatever language a person is using. Swearing, which I don't think means holding a Sefer Torah and taking a Shvuah, I think it means cursing. When a person expresses something passionate, it could depend on the culture and on the associations. That's one approach. It could just be the associations that they have in life from these different ideas. But there's something more than that. It's not just that a person grew up speaking Russian, so when they speak Russian, they have childhood memories, and that's how it's flavored. And now that they're speaking English, it's more detached. There's something else, too. I have a colleague, very close colleague of mine named Liora, she grew up in France, and she moved here when she was about 16 and had very little English in her. She had some English, but really started to develop English later, and now she's with me in graduate school, and we work together. I asked her about this. I said, you know, you're bilingual, you speak French, and you speak English. Do you have any personal experience with these studies that say that people, when they think in different languages, they're able to think differently or feel differently? And I'll read you her words. She texted this to me. She said, when I think in English about emotions, specifically uncomfortable emotions like sadness or anger, I'm able to process them a lot better in English than when I'm thinking in French, where a lot of times these emotions in France aren't discussed and aren't welcomed. Whereas America has a different, moving toward, understanding of mental health and ability to discuss anger and sadness. She said when she thinks English is her second language, but English has all these cultural associations of feelings. And there's certain words that come across better in English that she's able to process her feelings differently, especially her negative feelings, differently in English than she is in French. She also wrote to me, in French, my thought process is a lot more solution-focused, whereas in English, I'm much more process-focused. In English, she's thinking about the feeling, the experience, actually going through it. In France, it's what's the bottom line? When she thinks in French, she's thinking more about the value of what's the end result? How did I work it out? She told me there are other differences, too, in thinking in English versus thinking in French. I said, could you give me more examples? She said, it's hard to articulate. I said, could you say it in French? Maybe that'll be another difference if you could only explain it in French. She said, no, I can't explain it. Fine. She wasn't able to explain it. But this is an interesting idea. The idea that the culture, the language that we use, has different associations, has different tools by which the words that we use, the feelings that we have, the thought processes, the way that we're able to deal with emotions or able to problem solve, is different in different languages. Rav Dessler is telling us that Torah and Eretz Yisrael are our collective first language. They are our values-connected system of thought, of values, of prayer. Sometimes things get lost in translation. People want to know, should I daven in English? Sometimes, yeah, better to understand what you're saying. But there's something that's lost when you translate the words of the Gemara from Aramaic to English. Why? Isn't it about the content? To a large extent, yes. But we all know this. Sometimes we lose something in translation. Expressions don't have the same meaning. Or certain values lose their crux when you really translate it to another language. It gets blended. It gets filtered out. It gets lost some of its original passion or original masterpiece.
You get a shock a lot of times. It's much better in Yiddish. It's not the same thing.
Right. Jokes are always better in Yiddish, right? Especially the offensive number. The jokes are better in Yiddish, right? Expressions always have a lot of more wisdom, right? Make a lot more sense in Yiddish. That's what Rav Dessler is saying. That when we're in Chutz Laaretz, there's something watered down about the Kedusha. There's something different about the Kedusha. And that it doesn't come directly to us. It comes through the host language, through the host schools, through the host stop signs and regulations. Just being in another culture blends and adulterates the types of processes we're able to have. And that has a major impact on our relationship with Hashem as well. And for that reason, when Yaakov Avinu leaves Laban's house, his family said, that's all our stuff. And in a sense, it did come through them. Look now, page 130, page number 2, in the second paragraph. It's Kishachazar Yaakov Le'aretz Yisrael. When Yaakov Avinu does in fact leave Lavan's house, returning to Eretz Yisrael, Nishtana v'nis ala l'kabel hashbas Eretz Yisrael. Yaakov Avinu realized something was missing. He had production, he had blessings, children and wealth that had been filtered through Haran. Avla kelim rechusha, the things that he had amassed, lo nishtana, they remained chutz la'aretz productions. A quote from Rashi in Parshas Vayigash, Yaakov Avinu brings down his family to Mitzrayim, but Yaakov leaves behind all the things that he earned in Haran. Rashi comments, Yaakov gave those away. He gave them to Esav. Yaakov didn't want them. Any wealth he earned in Chutz La'aretz, he didn't want. Okay, how about his children? His children, 11 of his sons, plus Dina, were born in Chutz La'aretz. Does that make them tainted? To an extent, actually, yeah. There is a comment in the Medrash, in the Mechilta, that wants to know, why was the Beis HaMikdash specifically built in Binyamin's property? Of all the Shvatim, why was the Beis HaMikdash built in Binyamin's property? So one approach to the Mechilta is that Binyamin wasn't involved in Mechiras Yosef, and the Mikdash has to stand for bringing everyone together, and Achdus, very, very important. There's a second idea in the Mechilta. Binyamin was the only one of the Shvatim who was born in Eretz Yisrael. Where was he born? Beit Lechem. Rachel died, giving birth to him. She was buried in Beit Lechem. Binyamin was the only one of Yaakov's children born in Eretz Yisrael. And if we're going to have a temple that stands for our values, it can't come through the property of children who are born in Chutz La'aretz. Is there anything wrong with those children? Anything wrong with Hasidim or Yakis? Obviously not. Obviously not. But in terms of the true, authentic, direct line with Hashem, and his prophecy, and our value system, and the Torah HaKadosha, there's something special about Eretz Yisrael. Because it's not lost in translation, it's not affected by the host culture, or the host language, or the people's community laws. In Eretz Yisrael, we have a direct relationship with Hashem that is unfiltered. All of Yaakov's property that he earned in Chutz La'aretz, he wanted to put aside. Even his children, when it came time to have a temple on their properties, only Binyamin was chosen. For one reason, he was born in Eretz Yisrael. His property represents the direct connection with Hashem, the direct line of Mesorah that could only be in Eretz Yisrael. That's what Rav Dessler explains over here in the rest of this paragraph, in the brackets. Hayinyan, keep madregos gavos in higher terms. Hakelim sheishtamish behem atzadak la'avodas Hashem bebechinas chutz la'aretz. Once something has a chutz la'aretz flavor, einem ru'uyim od leishtamish behem l'madregos ha'gavos l'shma sheb'Eretz Yisrael, loses the capacity to be purely l'shma, purely unadulterated for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ki roshim ha'madrega harishona adai nishar behem. The initial culture, the initial mamalashon, remains with that property, remains with that production. That's why Yaakov Avinu had to start over with his property. The Beis HaMikdash only could be in Eretz Yisrael. In the next paragraph, he takes this a step further. He quotes from a Yalkut Shimoni, quotes from another Medrash, Masha Amru Chazal, Asida Eretz Yisrael, Shetisbashit L'chol HaRatzos. In the future, Eretz Yisrael is going to expand its borders and encompass the entire world. There are probably many different aspects to this idea, many Kabbalistic ideas, but Rav Dessler takes, based on what we said before, a very interesting approach. What do Chazal mean when they say in the future Eretz Yisrael is going to expand to all the different lands of the world? Perusha, ki levasof yagia begiluyo shel Mashiach tzedkenu gam leumos haolam. Eventually, when Mashiach comes, and he rebuilds the Beis HaMikdash, and he starts to spread the influence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his Torah to the whole world, af shelo bebechirasam, against their will, we're going to force everyone to recognize Hashem's presence. Aval ha'kopanam harei yakiru v'yedu kol yoshvei sevel. We say this in Aleinu. We say this in Aleinu, also in Yom Kippur. The second paragraph of Aleinu is a very important paragraph about everyone recognizing Hashem. We're looking to get to that day. And if that's the case where Hashem is now operating directly in all the lands, and that's Memela Tia, Az Gam B'chutz La'aretz Hashba B'derach Yishara. If Mashiach has direct influence in all the nations of the world, and everyone follows the same Torah basic guidelines, Torah guidelines for Jews, Torah guidelines for Bnei Noach, we're not going to accept Gerim when Mashiach comes, but everyone's going to be governed by Torah law of Bnei Noach. Everyone's going to recognize the temple, and everyone can come bring karbanos, even non-Jews, just like in the days of Shlomo HaMelech, they brought karbanos in the Beis HaMikdash. When the influence of Mashiach and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to be felt everywhere in the world, it's going to be all the Bechinas Eretz Yisrael. When the Medrash says in the future, Eretz Yisrael will expand to all the worlds, it means this level of direct relationship that we have with Hashem, where our Mesorah and our Torah, and it's all unadulterated and direct contact between God and us, that's going to one day be everywhere. Where nothing's going to be adulterated and filtered and primed through the host culture. It's all going to be directly to Hashem in the entire world. Amazing. And he says further, V'amru od, asidim batei kinesios ubatei midrashos shebebavel sheyikbu be'eretz Yisrael. This is a quote from the Gemara Maseches Megillah, based on Psukim in Sefer Yirmiyahu. The Gemara says, in the future, all of the shuls and all of the study halls that are in Chutz Laretz, Bavel is the example here, all of these study halls and shuls in Chutz Laretz are going to one day pick up, go on the eagle's wings, and they're going to be reestablished in Eretz Yisrael. Young Israel West Hempstead, all the young Israels in the world, all the different shuls and community learning centers are going to be relocated in Eretz Yisrael. What does that mean? Are we expecting bricks to fly? Maybe. Hold on to your sarim. But what he's saying on a deeper level is like this. Perish, shenichse chulin, shal Yisrael b'chutz laretz lo yikbu b'eretz Yisrael. All of the regular garden variety property we accumulate in Chutz Laretz has no right to go to Eretz Yisrael. Like Yaakov Avinu, we're not going to want things that have a Chutz Laretz hashpa, Chutz Laretz influence to come with us. Ke'enim ru'uyem liyos kelim avodas Hashem b'bechinas Eretz Yisrael. Because even if they're good, but if they have a native language that's from Chutz Laretz, they've been primed through that foreign culture, we don't want that. But something that we have over here is going to come with us to Eretz Yisrael. Those are our shuls. About the midrashos. There is a glimmer of hope for us who are living in Chutz Laretz at the moment, who are thinking, man, this is really awful. First of all, yeah, Chutz Laretz is pretty awful. We shall go to Eretz Yisrael. The small glimmer of hope is that at least our shuls, where we dive in directly to Hashem, our Bat Midrashos, where we study Torah for Hashem, Hashem talks to us, we talk to Him. That is, in the smallest sense, a direct relationship with Hashem that we have, even in Chutz Laretz. A Mikdash Ma'at. Oh, Mikdash Ma'at, what does that mean? A miniature version of that direct Hashba that we can accomplish here. The Torah is the same Torah, and the tefillah is the same tefillah. The Chazal say, Ein Torah ketorah Eretz Yisrael. And tefillah is obviously much more powerful in Eretz Yisrael. But at its core, these are not adulterated. Maybe the tunes that we use are picked up from the nations around us. Maybe the manner in which we daven sometimes, the style of our shuls, is based on the architecture of the buildings around us. That could be true. But at its core, tefillah and Torah are the same tefillah and Torah. And therefore the mitzvos that we accomplish here are things we can bring with us to Eretz Yisrael. The shuls and the study halls are going to come with us because they already have a flavor of Eretz Yisrael. They are our rare opportunities here in Chutz Laretz to have the direct Eretz Yisrael type connection with Hashem that is so hard at work, on the bus, on the subway, in the cabs. Only in Israel. Only in Israel do you have a cab experience with Bava Metzia, or the train operator wishing you a good Shabbos. Only in Israel. Only in Israel is everything felt through the culture of Lashon HaKodesh, of Jewish holidays, the schedule, the work schedule, being off on Friday instead of Sunday. Where do we get that from, being off Sunday? It's not a Jewish idea. Hello, we got it from the Christians. It's filtered through the host culture. In Eretz Yisrael, they're off Fridays, and they're off Chagim. We're off for like Earth Day and Flag Day. What a waste. Why am I taking off 12 and a half work days to take off for Shavuos? Because we're living in a host culture that's different. But in Eretz Yisrael, it's not like that. And you can complain about the government this and the government that. At the end of the day, to a large extent, the country's operating in Hebrew, Lashon HaKodesh, and the holidays are our holidays. The only thing we have in Chutz Laretz is our shuls and our Talmud Torah. Our tefillah and our Torah are the one unadulterated piece of our connection with Hashem, and that's coming with us. That has the status of Eretz Yisrael. There's an amazing Gemara Maseches Brachos. Gemara Brachos Daf Ches has a quote from Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan, who lived in Eretz Yisrael, was very bothered. He said, I don't understand how there are all these old people that are living in Chutz Laretz. There's like these West Hempstead senior programs. I don't know what they're doing. How can there be old people? Just smiling. How can there be old people in Chutz Laretz? Why was he bothered? We say in Kriya Shema every day, L'man yirbu yamechem v'yamei v'nechem al ha'adama that God swore to give to your forefathers. So wait a second. Torah promises a long life only for those who are in Eretz Yisrael. So Rabbi Yochanan wondered, how could it be that there are elderly people still alive, people with arichas yamim, in Chutz Laretz, if they're not al ha'adama that God promised to your forefathers? How can that be? When Rabbi Yochanan found out people were coming early and spending time in shul, he had his answer. That's what the Gemara says. The question is, what? What answer is that? Very nice, they go to shul and they spend a lot of time in shul, and that's a wonderful zechus. But it didn't answer his question. He was bothered by God promises a long life on the land of Israel. So how could you have a long life in Chutz Laaretz? What is going to shul make a difference? The Marsha there has a beautiful explanation. He says, because the shuls are a status of Eretz Yisrael. Yochanan wondered, how could it be? People in Chutz Laaretz are living a long life. And the answer is, they're not really in Chutz Laaretz. Because even when they're in Bavel, even when they're in Chutz Laaretz, they're attaching themselves, spending extra time in shul. That's our center. That's our satellite from Eretz Yisrael. Is it the same? No, because when you leave shul, to go outside, to go to the restroom, to go shopping, to get food, then you're not. In Israel, even the supermarkets and even the subways, or the trains, elevated train, even everything in Israel, only in Israel. But at least here, if we can attach ourselves to those centers, we are tapping into Eretz Yisrael satellites that we have. When the time comes, they're going to come back with us. And when Mashiach comes, we're going to spread that light to the whole world. Everywhere will be Bebechinas Eretz Yisrael. Everything will have the status of that direct connection that we have with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Oh, what an amazing idea. I'm going to pause here for a second. Any questions so far? Comments? Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam
Shehakol Nehiyah B'Dvaro. When we were growing up, there was Olamenu magazine.
Yeah.
And they had a story about, you know, imagined story about all the shuls landing at Ben Gurion Airport. And the yeshivas landing there.
I'm going to share for the Zoomers a story in Olamenu. Olamenu. Speaking of Olamenu. Our world. Olamenu about imagining the shuls actually landing in Ben Gurion Airport. About that actual prophecy. Beautiful. So now, he takes it one more step. Our last point for tonight. Rav Dessler points out in the next paragraph, Eretz Yisrael, Makom Re'ias Hanhaga. Only in Eretz Yisrael can we actually see Hashem running the world. And he writes, Be'Eretz Yisrael Anu Masigim Es HaTeva HaRuchani Shel HaBriya. We can actually see Hashem's hand, a spiritual operation of nature around us. And he quotes these psukim in V'Hayam Shemoa, that we recite every morning and every evening. V'Hayam Shemoa Tishma'u. If we observe the mitzvos, v'nasati mitar artzachem b'itau, you'll have rain. And he quotes in the Ramban, on the next page, on the last page, kol yisodos ha-torah b'nisim nistarim him. Normally Hashem runs the world in nature, where you can't see Hashem's hand operating. But in Eretz Yisrael, something is different. It makes no sense, the Ramban points out, that whether we keep Shemitah or not should have any effect on our agriculture. If it grows extra because we keep Shemitah, or we can't live in Eretz Yisrael because we don't keep Shemitah, that is a direct hashkacha of Hashem punishing and rewarding us based on our conduct in the land of Israel. And the same is true when it comes to rain that the Pesukim and Shema are talking about on the second line. V'hainu, Sheba'eretz ha'onesh, in the world of punishment, sorry, Sheba'eretz, in Eretz Yisrael, ha'onesh ba mehera, v'nitan l'ro'os es yad Hashem gam ba'ofek tzar yachasit. We're able to see Hashem in the narrow day-to-day nitty-gritties of life. Chutz Laaretz is governed by the different angels of Hashem or different saros in the government. There's some other form of leadership in Chutz Laaretz aside from Hashem's direct providence. It follows more of a natural progression. If you look at a gigantic lens, even the Chutz Laaretz, you can see Hashem on the macro level. But on the micro level, you could only see Hashem in Eretz Yisrael. And that's what Shema is telling us. At least at a time when we had prophecy, and we lived in the original Eretz Yisrael structure, whether they kept mitzvos or not would affect rain directly. They davened, rain came. They didn't, it didn't. That was such a direct hashkacha of Hashem. We could see Hashem's hand directly dealing with us. And he continues in the next paragraph. There's two promises of punishment for those who don't keep the mitzvos in Eretz Yisrael. Number one, that's that we're going to be unable to access rain from Hashem. He will not give us directly, hand to us, the rain that we need unless we do the mitzvos. And Beis, Va'avadata Mehira Me'ala Aretz, will be expelled from the land, the Hainu Galus. And this is so beautiful, the connection. Perish, B'tchila, Marim Yisrael Asateva Ruchani Shel Ha'aretz. The first line of punishment is for Hashem to say, don't you see what a direct connection we have here in Eretz Yisrael? You don't do mitzvahs? Rain turned off. You do? Faucet turned on. On, off, on, off. You had a bad day? Big football game last night and you weren't davening? Off. Next day, Yom HaKahal, a lot of learning Torah? On. Off, on, off, on. And if we can't see that, if we don't learn from the first step of having the rain turned off, which means if we don't improve and change with the direct reinforcement and punishment of Hashem dealing with us on a one-to-one direct level in Eretz Yisrael, you have to leave. Galus is stage two when we don't appreciate the direct connection in Eretz Yisrael. Because what's it going to help? If you don't learn after having this direct hashkacha turned off, it turns out, then you're not even on the same wavelength as what we're supposed to be thinking about when living in Eretz Yisrael. You have no choice. In other words, it's not just a happenstance of two different types of punishment. You're not behaving? No rain. Still not behaving? Get out. It's the rain is the greatest symbol that Hashem is dealing with us in Eretz Yisrael in the most direct way possible, because the consequences are immediate and visible. And if that doesn't inspire us to change our ways and be different, then don't be in Eretz Yisrael. It's only hurting you. And it doesn't work for you. You're missing the whole point of being there and experiencing the Hashgacha directly. You can't be here if you're not going to operate in that direct fashion with Hashem. And if you're not going to, goodbye. You can go somewhere else. You don't want to have a life where every mitzvah that you do is palpably felt in the consequences the next day? Then go to New York. Go somewhere else. Go live in Russia. Go live in Germany. Live somewhere else where you have an indirect relationship with Hashem. When you decide you want to come back to the level of having a direct relationship again, love to have you back. Come back to Eretz Yisrael. Come back to Eretz Yisrael where the connection with Hashem is one-to-one. It's one-to-one. But if you're not going to be doing that, then Galus comes. For us who are yearning to go back to Eretz Yisrael, for those living in Eretz Yisrael, we have to keep this in mind. It's not like Chutz La'aretz, where everything is filtered out by the host culture. Nothing is filtered. It's directly from Hashem. And we can't live there, and we can't thrive there, unless we have that realization that we're dealing with Hashem and His Torah and His mitzvos and His values one-to-one, in direct fashion. The Pesukim right before, V'hayam Shemoah, when they talk about the power of rain, this is Parshas Ekev, Perakid Aleph. Pesukim describe, Lo ke'aretz Mitzrayim hi. The land that you're going into is not like Egypt that you guys came from. Because this land doesn't operate by the Nile. It operates from direct rain from Hashem. Eretz asher Hashem elokecha doresh osa tamid. Tamid eini Hashem elokecha ba. This is a land that God always seeks out. Always is Hashem's eyes on this land. Mereshis hashana v'yad achar shana, for all year long. And then right after this, v'hayav shemal tashmu mutzvasai, keep mitzvahs, you get rain. If you don't, you don't. What is the contrast between Mitzrayim and Eretz Yisrael? So Rashi writes, one idea could be that in Mitzrayim you have to work really hard. You have to go to the Nile, get your bucket, fill up water, go back to your garden, and water your plants. But in Eretz Yisrael you're going to have rain, which means to say you could be sleeping in bed, Rashi says, and the rain's going to come down. Special bracha from Hashem, you don't have to do anything. He'll water your plants for you. But there's another approach. What is Hashem highlighting between this contrast of in Mitzrayim it was like the Nile, and in Israel you're going to have the rain? Many point out how there's a certain blessing and a curse from having our source of water from rain, in that we rely on Hashem to give it to us. In Egypt, we had the Nile. We didn't really need Hashem so much. Because if we didn't have access to water one day, it was a schlep, but you knew where to go. You go to the Nile, and you have your bucket. It was easy. It was always there for us. In Eretz Yisrael, we have to do mitzvahs. We have to have a relationship, which is obviously good when we're doing the right thing, and painful when we're not. But even in the curse of not having rain, there's a silver lining there. And this is the idea of the Chidushi Harim. The first Ger Rebbe pointed out, the curse of the Nachash, way back in Sefer Bereishis, seems to make no sense. God is angry at the snake for all that he does, and he says, that's it, snake, wherever you go, you're going to have dust to eat. Meaning, wherever you go, free food. All the time. No questions asked. Wait, can I get some of that? Wait, that's his curse? Man has to till the soil, and by the sweat of his brow has to work? And the snake who caused all these problems gets free food, his dust is his food, wherever he goes? That sounds awesome. Is it? Why is it a curse? The Chiddush Rim points out, the greatest curse is for Hashem to say, I don't want a relationship with you. You're out. Here, take the credit card, buy whatever you want, don't bother me again. but for the kid who he loves, here's an allowance. When it's out, you have to come back. You have to come crawling back. Hey, I'm never talking to you ever again, as teenagers tend to say. Could I have money? Could I have money? Please, Dad? Dad? Could I have money? Oh, hi! Where's my hug? No hug. Where's my high five? Where's our relationship? The Nachash's greatest curse is that I'm done with you. Take my credit card and never see me again. Mankind? You have to daven for it. You have to work for it. We have to always be in connection. The Gemara Maseches Yuma says that was why it was the greatest blessing for us. When we had the mun, we only got one day at a time. You couldn't keep the mun till the next day. It didn't last. Mark gives that example. You love someone, you don't give them the credit card and say, do whatever you want, don't talk to me again. If you love someone, you want an ongoing relationship with them, here's food for now. Come back tomorrow. Hope to see you then. Eretz Yisrael is that kind of relationship. Pesukim are describing. It's not like Egypt where you can get water whenever you want. Because if you could, good luck to your host culture. You can be assimilated. You can do whatever you want. In Eretz Yisrael, it's got to go through me, Hashem says. You got to daven for it. It's got to come directly through me. Does it make it harder sometimes? You bet. Does it make it more meaningful? So much more. Because the relationship, Tamid Eini Hashem Elokech Haba, God is directly observing it. Because it's Eretz Yisrael, where his direct influence is felt. Just end up with this last line, back in the Rav Dessler, in the last paragraph. When Yaakov Avinu finishes his journey, so he starts out in Laban's house, he earns all those things, and he comes back to Eretz Yisrael, he throws them away. He doesn't want them. He wants to have the children, the Beis HaMikdash, the property of Eretz Yisrael, the direct relationship with Hashem. And then Yaakov buys a field. Ibn Ezra there has an amazing comment. Ibn Ezra comments, Yaakov Avinu bought a parcel of land in Eretz Yisrael. Ibn Ezra says, those who are able to own Eretz Yisrael, to live in Eretz Yisrael, that is like owning a chelek of Olam Haba, the world to come. What is the connection between owning a land in Israel and owning land to come? Dessler explains so beautifully. He quotes from the Sforno on that same pasuk, who points out, Yaakov Avinu wanted to build a matzeva, a mizbeach to Hashem, and he can't build a mizbeach to Hashem al admas nechar, in a foreign culture, adulterated by the aspects of the foreign influence. Yaakov had to own it, to make it part of Eretz Yisrael, to make it through his influence, and then he could offer a service to Hashem, where it's underlined at the bottom. Bailis bekarka hidavar hamavlit b'miyuchadas anochiyos ha'adam. When a person settles down, when a person settles in a country, a person buys land, they are establishing their identity. This is who I am. This is what I associate with. This is my nationalism. This is what I'm representing. This is what I choose to associate with and be all about. When a person chooses to live in Eretz Yisrael, when a person is able to own a chelek in Eretz Yisrael, they are saying, I want my chelek. I want my identity to be in the place and the space with the direct relationship with Hashem. That's Olam Haba. That's a chelek of Olam Haba. You are choosing to identify and establish yourself in the country, the only place, only in Eretz Yisrael, only in Israel, does a person have a chance for that direct hashkacha with Hashem. If you choose to plant yourself there and fly the flag and build a home and establish the country's infrastructure and technology, you are identifying with a direct relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's Olam Haba. You are picking eternity with Hashem and His value system, His Torah, and His midos, and His mitzvos. It's a chelek of Olam Haba. Incredible idea. Incredible idea. Today, Yom HaAtzmaut, is a perfect time to express our appreciation for having bailus, having ownership over Eretz Yisrael. That we can establish our identities with Kedusha and mitzvos and that direct relationship with Hashem. For now, we'll have to cherish our Torah and our tefillah we can do in our Mikdash Ma'at, our satellite of Eretz Yisrael. But all the while realizing that our service here is largely indirect and very much affected by the culture around us. May it be that our tefillos and our learning today on Yom HaAtzmaut be a true zechus and an inspiration for all of us to return to Eretz Yisrael, where we can have again our direct connection with Hashem one-on-one, and Mashiach Tzidkenu to build the Beis HaMikdash and spread Gilui Shechina all over the world.